Okay, so we're in the final stretch. So there's so much killer stuff about the standard model that I want to fit in at least a taste of before we stop. I mean, what can I say? The level of detail in which we get to go into each of these things is going to go down, and we're just gonna sort of sail over and catch a glimpse and wave. You know, it's gonna look a little more like that. Okay, so hopefully it'll still be interesting. Okay, so this lecture, you know, the main point will be to meet the standard model effective field theory, neutrinos, left-handed neutrinos, right-handed neutrinos, masses and oscillations, dark matter, the matter-antimatter asymmetry of the universe, all sorts of good stuff. And then an introduction to anomalies. I have a feeling, I now have the self-awareness to know that we are not going to get through the anomalies material I prepared here, so that'll probably go over to the next lecture, but we'll do our best, and then have time in the remaining of the next lecture for some other fun stuff. Okay, but first I just wanted to finish the last slide of the previous class, and then because I'm a sucker for telling you guys more stuff, I actually added another slide to the end of the previous lecture today, because there's other good stuff. So just to remind you, you know that here we're going through, we introduced the idea of the renormalization group and the fact that couplings run, and then there's a bunch of different aspects of the standard model that then kind of can be understood, or best understood, once you understood those facts. And so in particular, we're going to talk about QCD, asymptotic safety, core confinement. I didn't mention it on the title slide here, but we talked about Landau poles and the fact that in the standard model they all seem to be off above the high energy ones turn off to be off above the Planck scale. And then I also want to tell you about the Higgs and whether the potential that we're living in is stable or unstable or possibly critical. So back to where we were. So we were learning about running couplings, and the key thing was that we said for the gauge couplings, if you solve for their equation how they run, and then you convert that equation to get this equation, you know, you see that depending on whether BI is whether this number BI, which for different gauge couplings can be different, it could be positive or negative, depending on that, you know, when you run to high energies, the coupling constant will either diverge at some finite lambda, which is called the Landau pole. And again, it's a very striking thing about the standard model that those all occur up beyond the Planck scale, where we can't even really trust the running anymore. So as far as we know, they don't occur. And then alternatively, if BI is negative, then alpha runs to zero as lambda runs to infinity. And that's called asymptotic freedom. And that's the way the strong force, the QCD force, the SU3 part of the standard model works. So let's talk a little bit about the SU3 part of the standard model. So when people talk about quantum chromodynamics, what they're talking about is focus on the quarks in the standard model, the ones that actually feel the SU3 force, and just focus on their interactions via the SU3 strong force, or the gluons, okay, the SU3 gauge boson. And then since, as we saw in the previous slide, the beta function for QCD for SU3 is negative, alpha is asymptotically free. Alpha, the SU3 gauge coupling here, that's what this 3 stands for, goes to zero as lambda runs to infinity. So the coupling constant that governs how strong the force is becomes very weak at very high energies. So when you're scattering quarks at very high energies, or scattering something off of quarks at very high energies, they seem to be binding to one another very weakly. They're at very short distances. However, because the beta function is negative, it means that if we now take the measured value of the strong force coupling constant at the electroweak scale, at the Z boson scale, and take it to lower energies, well, then we get a Landau pole. So it diverges to infinity when at a particular energy called the QCD scale, the QCD or quark confinement scale. And this is where basically not exactly a phase transition, but like a phase transition happens in QCD, where the coupling constant goes to infinity. Well, secretly that's telling you that perturbation theory has become terrible there. You no longer should trust perturbation theory. So below that scale, QCD becomes deeply non-perturbative, strongly coupled, and it behaves in a very different way. It no longer behaves like free quarks moving around and scattering off of each other. It has a very different description. So what is the description below that scale? Well, for lambda less than lambda QCD, for energy scales lower than that scale, or in other words, for length scales longer than 1 over lambda QCD, which is about the Fermi, about the size of a proton or a neutron, 10 to the minus 15 meters, that is. So for length scales longer than that, QCD is strongly coupled, non-perturbative, and although it has not been proved that this is the case, observationally, one finds it is the case that quarks are confined. You don't see free quarks running around in nature. Instead, they're all confined, that is to say, trapped together with other quarks or anti-quarks inside sort of very small bags whose size is roughly a Fermi, the 1 over the QCD scale. So they're, you know, they're trapped into little bound states that are about 10 to the minus 15 meters in size. And you know, they come basically in two types. There's mesons, which consist of a quark and an anti-quark that are bound together. Okay, that's called a meson because historically these ones are a little bit lighter. And the two most famous and most important mesons, I mean, the most famous, most important mesons are the pi mesons, which are just made out of up and down quarks. So that, for example, the pi plus is made out of an up quark bound to an anti-down quark. So if you add up the charges here, that's plus 2/3, and then down has minus 1/3, but an anti-down has plus 1/3, so this is 2/3 plus 1/3 is plus 1, so that's why there's a plus there. Electric charge, plus 1, I mean. And whereas the pi minus is the corresponding antiparticle, it's made of a down quark bound to an anti-up, so that one has electric charge minus 1, which is why we have a little minus superscript here. Okay, but then there's another way that they can be bound together. In this case, okay, so there's another way they can be bound together, which are called baryons. So that's where you have three quarks bound together. That's the statement that quarks are confined. The idea is that color, that at long distances, at low energies, what you don't see are any particles that have any remaining color charge. They have no remaining color indices. So notice that the mesons here don't have color indices because, oops, there, see, welcome to class. The mesons don't have color indices because, you know, for example here, U has an SU3 index, an up index, an SU3 upper index. D bar has an SU3 lower index, and they're contracted to make a color singlet. Okay, so this thing has no overall color. It's a scalar under color. This guy, what about this guy? Well, we have three quarks, each of which has an upper SU3 index, but SU3 has two invariant tensors. You know, SUN has two invariant tensors. It has the metric tensor, delta ij, the delta, Kronecker delta, but it also has the epsilon tensor, epsilon with n indices for SUN. That's an invariant tensor because under SUN, that's invariant if you think about it, because that's exactly the epsilon tensor is the tensor that remains invariant under when acted upon, when all of its indices are acted upon by a matrix with unit determinant. Again, using our formula for the determinant that we used earlier when we were showing that in the SU5 lecture, we showed that the P forms transform like the complex conjugate of N minus P forms, and when we did that, we used this identity that we wrote the determinant as an expression with an epsilon tensor on one side and an epsilon tensor on the other side. So if you think about it, that equation was saying that the epsilon tensor is invariant under SUN, and so in particular, we can take this three-component invariant epsilon tensor for SU3, contracted with the SU3 indices on three quarks, and make another sort of object that also has no free SU3 indices. So this thing has no overall color either. And then the antibaryons are made of three anti-quarks, and their color indices can be wrapped up with an epsilon in exactly the same way. And so the most famous, so when you say quarks are confined, technically what you mean is that the bound states are all appear to be, the only allowed bound states at low energies appear to be ones that have no free SU3 indices, they're SU3 scalars. So the most famous baryons are the proton, which is consisting of two ups and a down. So if you add up the charges, that's two-thirds, two-thirds, and minus a third, so that's plus one, which is the charge of the proton, the electric charge. Or the neutron, which is one up and two downs, and there if you add up the charges, you'll get zero. And then the antiproton and antineutron have the opposite charges. Okay, and in this lightning review of quantum chromodynamics, the one other thing I wanted to mention was that, you know, there's a kind of famous picture of what's going on with quark confinement, physical, you know, besides just the statement that observationally we see that color is confined, there is a theoretical picture of why, which has been then essentially confirmed by lattice QCD in more recent years. But famously, it was this picture was already, you know, found in the late 60s, and then ultimately historically led to the development of string theory. String theory famously started as an explanation of the strong force and then turned into an explanation of gravity instead later on. But so what's the idea? Well, the idea is that the reason that quarks are confined is that it's like they are bound by a force, which is a string with some tension. So, you know, unlike a spring where the restoring force grows linearly with the amount that you stretch it, a string, as opposed to a spring, the restoring force is just constant as you stretch it, okay? There's just some constant tension in the string. So, you know, if you have a restoring force like a spring that grows linearly, the potential grows quadratically. If you have instead a string where the restoring force grows is a constant, then the potential for that force grows linearly with distance as you stretch the two quark and anti-quark apart, for example. And so the idea is that since you have them bound in this potential that grows linearly, as you try to stretch them apart, there gets to be a point where this state, where the string is stretched by this amount, when you've tried to stretch it too much more than 10 to the minus 15 meters, you can create this. It's energetically favorable for the string here to split into a quark and anti-quark pair, so that this quark and this anti-quark can form a bound state now with this quark with a shorter stretch, and this anti-quark, the new anti-quark, can form a bound state with this. Yep.
I think the bottom.
The screen.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. So these. How much has been missed here? I formed a quark anti-quark pair here, and the new quark binds now with the old anti-quark, and the new anti-quark binds with the quark, and now this has less energy, this lower state, than the upper one, and so that's why, if you try to separate, try to take a quark and an anti-quark too far apart, you don't actually ever get to see them far apart from one another. Instead, you just produce more tightly bound states. You produce two mesons instead of getting two widely separated quarks and antiquarks. And so somehow the physical picture of what's going on here is, you know, if you think of electromagnetism, you know, if you have a charge here in electromagnetism, then the force field, you know, the field lines all point radially away, and so they become more and more spread out as they get further from the charge. And you know that in electromagnetism, as the field lines get less dense, that's telling you that the field strength is going down. And so if you have a quark, if you have a charge and an anti-charge in electromagnetism, you know, the field lines sort of bow out, and they form some sort of pattern like this. And they get less dense in between the two quarks, electric charges. And as you pull the electric charges further and further apart, you know, this bowing out just gets, these loops just get bigger and bigger, and the density between the two guys gets smaller and smaller. So the force, yeah. So whereas the picture is that what's happening in QCD is that the the force, the SU3 gauge field, the lines of force are instead sort of sticking to each other. So they don't bow out. They all get kind of stuck here. It's like they all remain squished along the line between the quark and anti-quark pair. So now as I stretch them, unlike in the electromagnetic case, since they're all kind of pinned to lie along the line between the two quarks, you know, the field lines don't stretch out at all. Don't get less dense, you know, don't get further away from each other as I separate the two quarks. So that's telling you that the force is not dropping off as I separate the two the two quarks. Instead it's just a constant, which is exactly what this model of a string is basically capturing. Okay, and then the final late addition slide, one more crucial thing about the standard model, which is best understood in terms of running of the couplings, is the question of whether the Higgs potential that we're living in, the vacuum that we're currently living in, is stable or unstable, or metastable. So what's the idea in brief? Well, so in the last time we met the Wilsonian action, S lambda, this action runs with scale, and so we know that in the standard model, the action, the potential term for the Higgs in the action is this quartic function. There's the minus m squared times h dagger h term, and then there's the plus lambda times h dagger h, whoops, I should say. Squared. But we learned yesterday that the value of these coupling constants runs with scale. It runs with the energy scale lambda at which the action, the Wilsonian action is defined. And so here's how it runs with scale. As soon as people measured the Higgs mass, it suddenly became, you know, which happened in 2014 or something, it suddenly became possible to actually extrapolate up and take all that you suddenly had all the information you needed to extrapolate to run all the standard model couplings up to high energies. And in particular, you could run this quartic coupling of the Higgs up to high energies, and the best fit value at the time looked like it was, actually this is still what the best fit value does roughly. It starts positive down at the energies we see it, and then it, but then if you run it up to 10 to the 11 GeV, so about a billion times higher than the LHC actually can probe, it appears to go negative, appears to cross zero, and so stay zero below there for at least a long time, up to the, basically, and this is as far as we can, up to the Planck scale here, 10 to the 19 GeV is as far as we can really trust these running that ignores gravity. Now, why is that important? Well, because it turns out that actually, at the quantum level, the function whose minimum, so far we've been acting like it is this function whose minimum determines where the VEV of the Higgs field sits. And that is true in some approximation, but the more correct thing is that there is this thing called the effective action, gamma, which I don't have time to define for you, but that's an action which at zeroth order in H bar is equal to the ordinary action S, but then there's corrections at order H bar, H squared, et cetera, which are kind of one loop, two loop, et cetera, corrections to the action. And it's this guy whose minimum actually determines where the VEV of H is. And to make a long story short, the expression for the potential, for the effective potential, the potential for H appearing in this sort of quantum corrected action, is actually just V lambda, but where every time we had a lambda appearing in this previous expression for the Wilsonian potential, we make the substitution that lambda actually goes to the absolute value of H. So now we have, it's not a quartic function of H anymore. It's the old quartic function of H, but now the coupling constants also depend on H. Much more weakly, but they do depend. So if we plug in particular, this term dominates at very high values of h. If we plug in this running formula, then what it's saying is that, okay, I've tried to do a little sketch here, but it doesn't do justice. That, okay, here's sort of where the potential is, the potential we know and love. That we have our Higgs potential, and it first has this little minus m squared phi squared. It dips down a little bit, and then here's our dinky vacuum here. We live in this little minimum here, and then for a long time the potential grows just as if it was a nice quartic potential. But then, here, where at around 10 to the 11 GeV, where lambda crosses through zero, the potential, if that's really what happens, the potential suddenly tanks and goes negative and has a huge, incredibly negative minimum somewhere out God knows where that's, much, 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 much deeper than the actual minimum that we live in, okay? So if that's really the way the world is, we're currently sitting in this minimum, but this is not the true minimum. And eventually, after some amount of time, a little bubble of true vacuum will form by quantum tunneling in the real minimum, and then it will grow at the speed of light and eventually swallow everything. Now, it turns out that because of how high this energy is, because of this large gap, the estimated time for that to happen is much longer than the current age of the universe, so it's not going to happen tomorrow, very likely. But nevertheless, so possibly that's sort of the best fit supposedly value of what the standard model predicts if you really take it seriously, up to high energies. However, an important thing to say is that when this calculation was first done after the Higgs mass was measured, it looked like the favored, you see there's some, of course all these parameters are only measured with some error, and the runnings are only known with some error, and so if you include the errors, there are nearby trajectories, like this dotted one here, that it goes down, it gets close to going negative, but it never does, and then it goes back up. And then there's a kind of critical trajectory which goes down and actually, basically asymptotes to zero, or hits zero at the Planck scale, and then turns back up if you believe the running beyond that point. Initially, it looked like those trajectories were excluded by something like 3 sigma, which is not huge evidence in particle physics, but nevertheless was pretty strong. Now it's come down to like the difference between this trajectory and this trajectory, as better calculations and measurements have been done, is more like 1 or 1.5 sigma. So actually, the evidence that we're living in this sort of universe where the potential tanks this way is not strong at all. It's quite weak. And so it's quite possible that we live in a universe that just does this or this. And in fact, a very striking thing was before the Higgs mass was discovered, there were all these papers that were predicting what the Higgs mass was going to be, and of course most of them got it wrong. One that famously got it right on the nose was this very interesting paper by Shaposhnikov and Vedderick, who took the sort of asymptotic safety perspective that our whole theory flows to a consistent fixed point in the UV. And so they said, oh, well, they said, from that standpoint, we expect lambda to run to zero in the UV. So if we set it to zero up here and then run it down, we can predict the value of the Higgs mass. And famously, they predicted it right on the nose that way. So another way to look at it is that the fact that the Higgs mass has been observed where it is within within error bars, it corresponds to this critical trajectory, maybe is some evidence, not super strong evidence, but some interesting, intriguing evidence that maybe something like this is going on. Anyway, okay, so that's all I was going to say about RG stuff.
Can you can you explain again the vacuum bubble, what you said before?
Yes. So the whole story is very analogous to what happens. So very analogous. If you plot the free energy in statistical mechanics, and the free energy maybe has you know, one minimum, and then but then it has a lower minimum somewhere. So if you start, if the system is up here, but it has a lower minimum somewhere else, that's telling you the system is going to undergo a first order phase transition where little bubbles, depending on how big this bump is, it may take a longer or shorter time, but if you wait long enough, little fluctuations will form bubbles in this new region randomly. But once little bubbles in this new region form, if they're big enough, then it's energetically favorable for the system for those bubbles to grow. And eventually, so you'll get, you know, so it's like when you boil water, you know, you get tiny little bubbles of steam, but if the temperature is high enough, the energetically most favorable thing, once a little bubble of steam forms, is for it to grow, and so you get little bubbles of steam that grow until they collide with each other, and eventually there's no water left, only steam. So the analogous thing happens, but now it's quantum fluctuations instead of thermal fluctuations, and instead of, you know, steam and water, it's the new true vacuum versus the old true vacuum. And unlike in bubbling water, in a relativistic field theory, the new bubbles grow basically at the speed of light according to an external observer. And so according to an external observer, you would have this almost exactly speed of light bubble. You would see an almost exactly speed of light bubble coming out, and then as it swept past you, a lot of things would change. You know, the masses of all the particles would change because the Higgs vav had changed from 100 GeV to, let's say, the Planck scale. Suddenly, the particles would all become 10^17 times heavier, and life would be very different after the bubble swept past you. So,
what does the word bubble mean here?
Yes, sorry. What I mean to say is just that it is a new region in three-dimensional space. It's a little spherical region. It started its life as a little spherical region in three-dimensional space that initially was very microscopic. So it started, when it started off, maybe its size was not much bigger than the Planck scale. But outside the bubble, the vacuum energy was our vacuum energy, very small and positive vacuum energy that we see in the world around us today. Inside the bubble, the vacuum energy was instead this extremely negative, humongous vacuum energy. And then this three-dimensional thing, that's the story on the time slice where the bubble first forms. But then, you know, if you look at time slice later, the bubble will have grown a little bit. And now the interior region that has this huge negative energy will be bigger. And how fast has it grown? How fast has the size grown? Well, the slope, according to an outside observer, is roughly the speed of light. It very quickly approaches the speed of light.
That picture, like that time evolution, can we think it as an RG flow, or it's not? And like, if you talk about phase transition.
So. I don't think you would think of it as a phase. No, I don't think so. I think that's actual dynamical evolution of the field. It's really that there's a classical field configuration, and it is very inhomogeneous, and this is how that inhomogeneity wants to evolve. So, no.
Thank you.
Okay. Sorry, my iPad keeps logging me out. So much for that lecture. Let's move to lecture 12. So the standard model of vector field theory, neutrinos and anomalies. So here is our beloved standard model table. Throughout the course, there's been this one row which has a different status from everybody else because we haven't actually directly detected the particles in this row, so we don't really know that they exist. And so I want to, for much of the course, we've focused on the so-called minimal standard model where we ignore this row. And moreover, we then consider the most general renormalizable Lagrangian made from the remaining particles in the remaining five rows. So that's the so-called minimal standard model, or what used to be just called the standard model. And we said, you know, we went to great lengths to write down the complete theory and analyze it, but we said it's great, amazing theory, it has very successful theory, but it has three things that it really can't account for in nature. Okay, so it does three observational puzzles. First is that neutrinos are observed to have masses and to oscillate between flavors. So when we analyzed the masses of the minimal renormalizable standard model, we found that all the particles do become massive except for the neutrino, which remains a mass, unlike everybody else, remains a massless vial fermion. On the other hand, ever since the 1960s, John McCall had predicted the number of neutrinos that were being generated, the flux of neutrinos being generated by the nuclear reactions at the center of the sun. Ray Davis did an experiment in a mine to actually measure the flux of neutrinos to check his answer and found only a third of the neutrinos that were predicted were actually reaching the Earth. That was already this famous hint, but that nobody was really paying attention to at the time, that neutrinos maybe did have a mass, but then in the late 90s, Snow Lab here in Canada and Superkami Okada in Japan, you know, really nailed the fact that neutrinos really are clearly oscillating as if they have mass. So this is one thing which the minimal standard model does not account for. The minimal standard model also cannot explain the observed matter and antimatter asymmetry in the universe. So in the early universe, to produce the universe we see today, There was an early period where the temperature was so high that protons and antiprotons were in thermal equilibrium. Baryons were and antibaryons were in thermal equilibrium, so they had a much higher abundance than they do today, and they were almost equal in abundance. But then they annihilated when the temperature dropped below their mass. They annihilated. Protons and antiprotons annihilated with one another, but when they did, there had to be roughly, for every billion antiprotons, there had to be roughly a billion and one protons, so that there was one per billion protons left over that didn't annihilate to get the right abundance of matter in the universe today. And so, you know, a puzzle is to try to explain why there was that asymmetry in the early universe, and the minimal standard model does not have any explanation for that. Finally, it appears to be the case that there is five times more so-called dark matter in the universe than ordinary matter. Well, there's something going on. Once you get to scales of galaxies or larger, if you assume that just the only matter in the universe is the ordinary matter in the periodic table, that just does not account for observations. So something's going wrong. You know, one possibility, which is the thing which is most successful so far in fitting all of the observations when considered as a whole, is that there is dark matter which is roughly five times as abundant as the ordinary matter in the periodic table. You know, another possibility which people think about is that maybe what you're seeing is that something is going wrong with Einstein's theory of gravity as you get to those large scales. Maybe our theory of gravity is breaking down. And that's a possibility. You know, at present, that there is no theory of that sort that is as successful an explanation of the observations as dark matter. But until we know, you know, we don't know. But I think so. Anyway, we don't know. But I think probably there is dark matter because it fits better. Anyway, so there's something going on there. Either way, there's something going on there that the minimal standard model of particle physics coupled to GR does not account for. Okay, so these are the three things that the minimal standard model coupled to GR does not account for. I mean, actual observational clashes, not you know, interesting puzzles that we'd like to explain, but actual discrepancies with the data. Okay, so then I want to differentiate between three models here. There's the minimal standard model, SM, which I just described, where we omit the right-handed neutrino row, and we omit all the non-renormalizable terms, and we said that doesn't explain any of those three puzzles I just mentioned. Now then there is the so-called standard model effective field theory. That's where we still omit the right-handed neutrino row, but now instead of only including the renormalizable terms, we do include the non-renormalizable terms. So instead of just including all the operators that are Lorentz invariant and gauge invariant and have mass dimension less than or equal to 4, which is what we did to get the minimal standard model, we remove that third assumption, we include terms that have mass dimension 5, 6, etc. And that turns out to do a beautiful job, as I'll explain more in a moment, of resolving problem one, but it still has nothing to say about problems two or three. So that extended theory does better, can't account for everybody. And it's more incomplete than the standard model in the sense that it is a non-renormalizable theory, which has now an infinite number of couplings instead of a finite number of couplings, and no well-defined UV completion. Finally, there is the what's sometimes called the new SM, the neutrino standard model. That's where we do include the right-handed neutrino line here. And now we don't need to go beyond renormalizable terms. So we'll include the right-handed neutrino line, and we'll again omit the non-renormalizable terms. Then that theory then nicely explains all three puzzles, one, two, and three. It's more complete than the standard model effective field theory in the sense that it's renormalizable again, so it just has a finite number of couplings, not many more than in the minimal standard model. Moreover, as we saw, it fits better with all the different patterns that we saw seem to be these governing patterns in the standard model. So spin 10 and spin 10 requires, you know, each generation transforms as a 16. So the 16 is only a 16 because the right-handed neutrino is there. If you removed the right-handed neutrino, there would only be 15 particles per generation. That whole scheme would fall apart. Similarly with SU5, although in principle you can have SU5 unification without the right-handed neutrino, that whole nice story, the thing which makes it so nice about it being just about this structure lambda C5, that all would fall apart. So it seems to fit better with the pattern, complete the pattern of the standard model. So let's look at first what the standard model effective field theory is and how it resolves problem one. Because at some level this is almost certainly the correct explanation of what's going on with pattern one. It's just this may not be the full theory. But this is probably the correct low-energy a very good low-energy approximation to particle physics on Earth. So what's the story? Well, the question is, we want to go on now. We want to ask instead of stopping at the terms in the standard model that have dimension 4, we now want to include the terms that have dimension 5, dimension 6, etc. And the idea is that in effective field theory, in the effective field theory approach, there is an explanation from Ken Wilson's renormalization group argument. There is an explanation for why, if you have a theory that holds up to some very high energy scale lambda, some very high cutoff scale lambda, the highest scale at which the theory applies, but then you do physics at some scale way below that, that for all intents and purposes, just the renormalizable terms will dominate the answer at those very low energy scales. And then the leading correction will become, you know, so the terms up to dimension 4 will be the important ones. Those will be the so-called relevant operators or marginal irrelevant operators. All the ones of dimension 5 and higher are quote-unquote irrelevant operators, which reflects the fact that they become very unimportant for low-energy physics. But the ones with the lowest dimension, the irrelevant operators with the lowest dimension are the most important. So the most important correction to the renormalizable standard model would be expected to be the dimension 5 terms. And then after that, the next most important would be the dimension 6 terms, etc. So Weinberg famously was the first to ask, well, what are all the dimension 5 terms you can write down in the standard model? And he discovered there's only one, actually. So there's actually, you know, even though there's all sorts of dimension 4 terms, there's only one dimension 5 term you can write down. It's called the Weinberg term. And it gives a beautiful explanation for neutrino masses and oscillations. So let's see what that term is. So first I want to define this field here, psi left. What is it? It's just L left. It's just the L left of the ith generation, contracted with H, the Higgs field, twiddle, dagger. Okay, so in other words, if you think about what's happened here, I've created a field which transforms under Lorentz transformations, like a spinner, it has the same Lorentz indices as the left-handed lepton does, because the Higgs field doesn't have any Lorentz scalar, it doesn't contribute anything to the Lorentz transformation properties. So it's a space-time spinner, but now if we ask what its gauge transformation properties are, it's a scalar under all three gauge groups. It's an SU3 times SU2 times U1 singlet. Why is that? Well, we've built it from two fields which both have SU3 charge, have no SU3 charge, or are SU3 singlets, so the combined thing is an SU3 singlet. We've contracted this guy's SU2 index with this guy's SU2 index, so it's an SU2 invariant. And then also, you know, if you look back at the table, you'll see L left has hypercharge minus a half, H has hypercharge plus a half, so that H twiddle dagger also has hypercharge plus a half, so that the total hypercharge here is zero also. So this is a left-handed spinner, completely gauge invariant, but it has an unusual mass dimension. It has mass dimension 5/2, unlike our ordinary spinners like L, which have mass dimension 3/2. So just like when we were building the full standard model Lagrangian with the right-handed neutrino, remember the right-handed neutrino also had, the right-handed neutrino was also invariant under all SU3 times SU2 times U1 transformations. And so we could build an unusual type of term for it, a Majorana mass term that wouldn't be allowed for the other term. So that was something that looked like new right C bar times MIJ times new right J. So same goes for this new field psi. We can write down an analogous term for it. So that's what we've done here. I've taken this new psi left field, I've taken its charge conjugate and its bar, contracted it with psi left itself, and then I've, in between the ith and jth generation, because any combination of I and J is possible, I'm going to include a whole matrix of 3x3 matrix of couplings there. Yeah, with psi left, we can write down this term, and that's the so-called Weinberg term. That's the only dimension 5 term you can write down using just the fields in the minimal standard model. So that's predicted. It was his prediction for the leading correction to the low-energy standard model once you go beyond renormalizable terms. And now, just like we did before, if we want to extract, you know, the physical content, we need to break the Higgs field into its VEV part and the Higgs field, and so in particular to extract the a mass term, we're going to just focus on, you know, so if we now plug this expression into H twiddle here, and then we see that psi left involves the first term, which is just the Higgs VEV times the left-handed neutrino. Coming from contracting H twiddle dagger with the left-handed lepton doublet. And then there's another term here which we'll ignore, which is the left-handed neutrino times capital H, the Higgs field. So if we just focus on this leading term here, then the Weinberg term becomes a Majorana mass term for the left-handed neutrino, where this new mass matrix M is just, well, it's this new Y matrix times the coefficient 1 over lambda, which we had to put in front of this term to get the dimensions right. Yeah, I should say, I think I explained that badly. So we were able to write down this term, which was Lorentz invariant and gauge invariant. But because this guy has mass dimension 5/2 and this guy has mass dimension 5/2, if this guy is a dimensionless matrix, then in order to make the term in the Lagrangian have mass dimension 4 like it should, we need to divide by some mass scale lambda here, which is some number, but in particular in the effective field theorist would expect this to be roughly the cutoff energy scale for this theory. So some high energy scale, much higher than we've observed, or else we would have seen the standard model breakdown. So when we just plug in everything, the prediction here is that the mass matrix for the low energy neutrinos are no longer zero. They are proportional to the square of the Higgs vev divided by this very high energy scale lambda. So in the limit that lambda is very large, much larger than the Higgs vev, this explains why the neutrino masses are very small, because in the limit that this thing goes to infinity, they go back to zero. But if it's not infinity, then we get this nice non-zero masses for the neutrinos, and roughly speaking, this thing, to match observations, if you take the y's to be of order 1, you would estimate lambda as something like 10 to the 13 GeV or something like that. But if the y's are much smaller than 1, then lambda could be much bigger than 10 to the 13 GeV and still be compatible with observations. Too much detail about this. Sorry, recalibrating. When I was younger, before map apps worked as well as they do now, there was this period where if you were driving in your car and instead of using a map app to tell you which way to go, you made a wrong turn, it said recalibrating. It's like it said out loud, like recalibrating, and you had to wait for a while for it to decide what the new route was. Okay, anyway, so that's like me right now. So to make a long story short, let me maybe not explain this in too great detail, but just to say that the effect of this is that for very similar reasons to remember that when we were dealing with the quarks, we found that when an up quark of the ith generation emitted a W boson, it became a down quark of the ith generation, but these were not the mass eigenstates. When we converted to the mass eigenstates, the D primes, there was a conversion matrix so that there was a difference between the weak eigenstates and the mass eigenstates. So when there was no mass term in the lepton sector, the leptons did not have that property. There was no distinction between the weak eigenstates and the mass eigenstates. But now that we include this dimension 5 term, if you go back and rethink through that analysis, you'll see that there is. So now, at the center of the sun, in a nuclear reaction at the center of the sun, which is made of electrons, what you get produced at the center of the sun is a electron neutrino. It's a weak eigenstate. It's the partner of the electron in the weak basis. But then what propagates to the Earth are mass eigenstates. What determines how you propagate through space-time, how your wave function changes, e to the I k dot x, where k squared is equal to minus the mass squared, that depends on the mass. What k's are allowed depends on the mass. What momentum you have at a given energy depends on your mass by that relation. So this splits into three mass eigenstates, and they each propagate with different phase evolution as a function of on their way here. And so then when you redetect them in a detector on Earth, again, the way you detect them is by they bonk into a neutron or a proton, which is made of particles in a particular weak basis, and so you're anyway. So you see interference effects, and that's how you see flavor oscillations being related to masses. In brief, sorry to not be able to go through that in more detail. Okay, so let's talk then about the other possibility that I mentioned on the previous slide. So the new SM where we actually include the right-handed neutrino. So we derived this Lagrangian earlier in the class. This is just now we're going to include all the terms that we previously had included in Google brackets. So these are all the, this is now all the Lorentz invariant, gauge invariant for normalizable terms, built from our table, but now including the right-handed neutrino. Well, because, so what's different? Well, first let's imagine that this term is absent. Okay, so first imagine that the Majorana mass term for the right-handed neutrino is absent. Well, now, so the new thing on the kinetic line is that we have a kinetic term for the right-handed neutrino in addition to the kinetic term for the left-handed neutrino. So remember, after spontaneous symmetry breaking before, we found that all the other types of fermions could be grouped into Dirac fermions, which had nice Dirac kinetic terms. But before, with the minimal standard model, the left-handed neutrino was an oddball. It had still a Weyl kinetic term, just two-component fermion kinetic term. But that's no longer the case. Now the story is exactly analogous. You know, now the leptons and the quarks are very analogous in the standard model. So now the right-handed and left-handed quark also group, right-handed and left-handed neutrino also group into a Dirac neutrino nu. Same goes for the mass terms. If you just go through the analysis, basically what I'm trying to say is that now if you look at this, Lagrangian, there's complete analogy between the three quarks terms here, one left-handed doublet and two right-handed singlets, and the lepton terms, one left-handed doublet and two right-handed singlets. And so everything we previously worked out for the quarks, the analogous thing exactly goes through for the leptons if we redo all the analysis. And so we're just going to have exactly analogous story for the mass terms, for the kinetic terms, Dirac mass terms and kinetic terms for the leptons and quarks now, including the neutrino. So in this situation, we now have three Dirac neutrinos. And so that's a total of 12 states. 3 times 4 equals 12 physical states because, so in other words, these particles, they come in three different masses, okay? But since they're Dirac fermions, Dirac mass terms, each mass is associated with, can come in four different states. It can either be particle or antiparticle, and either of them can have spin up or spin down. Four states per mass. Okay, now, what about in the more general case where we include, so, and that would be, if that was the situation, we would say neutrinos have Dirac masses, which has not been ruled out yet, could be the case. However, you know, we see that the more general possibility is that this term is present, and so what's the physics if this term is present? Well, then the story, so if the Majorana mass term for the right-handed neutrino is there, is it, if it's non-zero, then we have a different story. Now we get 6 Majorana neutrinos. And that's, again, the same 12 states. The number, total number of states doesn't change, but the arrangement is different. Now there's 6 different possible, 6 different masses. The neutrinos come in 6 different masses, each of which has only 2 states. So for a total of 12 states. So you have 6 Majorana masses, but 2 states per mass. So now, you know, a given state of a given mass can either be a particle of, it's complicated to explain. It can either be a particle with spin up, which is equivalent to, or automatically occurs in combination with the corresponding antiparticle of spin down, or it can be the particle of spin down, which is automatically occurs in combination with the corresponding antiparticle of spin up. So there's only two states. The particles and antiparticles are, it's a whole complicated story, which I leave for either a previous or a coming quantum field theory class. But one thing to say in this case is that in very briefly, if you look at how the mass matrix now looks for these 6 states, well, there's a kind of 3x3 upper block here, which is given by this mass matrix M, this 3x3 mass matrix M, so that's on the diagonal because that's right-handed neutrinos coupling to right-handed neutrinos. There's no corresponding term for left-handed neutrinos coupling to left-handed neutrinos, but now there's this. There's also these off-diagonal terms. What we called that's exactly this so-called Dirac mass here. That's a 3x3 off-diagonal matrix here and here. I probably should have written a dagger here, but anyway, this is just meant to be schematic. I'll write the dagger later. Yes, because this is off diagonal because remember these Dirac mass terms couple a right-handed neutrino bar to a left-handed neutrino. So now we need to diagonalize this matrix to find the actual mass eigenstates. So if you diagonalize a matrix like this, and if M is a lot bigger than little m, if capital M is a lot bigger than little m, then you find that the three of the eigenvalues are of order capital M, so there are three heavy neutrinos, and the remaining three eigenvalues are tiny. They're of order little m squared divided by capital M. So as m gets very big, these guys are very heavy. The remaining three eigenstates are very light. So this is called the seesaw mechanism. And so in that picture, what we've actually observed are these three very light neutrinos, but there's in addition three very heavy neutrinos up here. Okay, and so. Very briefly, this model, so not only, one way to say it is that if these heavy neutrinos are heavy, if you can so-called integrate them out, and then this theory actually reduces, the remaining theory, the effective theory reduces to the standard model effective field theory that we saw before. So in any case, it does an equally good job for that reason of describing the oscillations of neutrinos, the observed oscillations of the light neutrinos. But it now also gives a nice explanation called leptogenesis for why there is an antisymmetry of matter and antimatter in the universe, that if you take one of these, you know, it turns out we know observationally that two of these heavy neutrinos have to be unstable, so they would have decayed very early in the early universe. And you might think if you have a Majorana neutrino that's equal to its own antiparticle, then when it decays in the early universe, it would have to decay into an equal amount of matter and antimatter. But it turns out that that's not true. That if the theory is CP violating, so if the theory contains coupling constants that are intrinsically complex, you can't do any field redefinition to remove all the complex numbers from the coefficients. There's no field redefinitions you can do to make all the coefficients real. Coupling constants real, then the theory is CP violating, and then it can have this property that when these heavy neutrinos decay, they can have a different branching ratio to particles and antiparticles, in particular to leptons and antileptons. And so anyway, that's completely compatible with everything we know about the theory. There are unmeasured coupling constants in the neutrino sector of this theory that if they have the right values, then as these things decay in the early universe, they will produce an overabundance of a slight overabundance of leptons compared to antileptons, and that would be the explanation in this theory for why it was perfectly compatible with the thing that we see with the observed antisymmetry between matter and antimatter. And then the final thing to say is that there is a nice dark matter candidate in this theory, which there was none in the previous theory, but in this theory, there's one of these three guys, one of these three heavy guys can still be exactly stable, Basically, if the Lagrangian is symmetric under that neutrino goes to minus itself, that turns out to simultaneously make that neutrino stable and also make it completely dark in the sense that it completely decouples from everything else in the model except for gravity. So that's the good news, is that a single symmetry makes it both stable and dark, which is the kind of two primary things you need for dark matter. And the only question is, how do you produce enough of it to actually fill the universe with dark matter today? And there's two ways you can do it, in short. There's one way that was where it oscillated from the thermal plasma at early times. And that explanation, once upon a time, looked like the most elegant explanation, but the simplest versions of it were ruled out, unfortunately. And so now it does not look like the most elegant explanation. It looks still, there's still a way to make it work. And Misha Shaposhnikov, one of the great cosmologists in the world, is the leading expert on that. Possibility, it looks to me that you have to, there have to be coincidences, and it doesn't look as good. I don't think it's, anyway, best possibilities got ruled out. There's another possibility, which is that, which is this more recent thing, which we pointed out a couple of years ago, that if the universe is really, if you take seriously the maximal analytic extension of the space-time we live in, it has an extra symmetry. There's a part, in addition to the part of the space-time after the bang, there's a kind of analytic extension of it before the bang, and that space-time has an extra symmetry that you don't notice if you don't do the full analytic extension. But once you do notice it, if you take it seriously and ask that the fields, then there's a preferred state for the fields living on that extended space-time, which is the CPT symmetric state. If you take the hypothesis that the fields really are in that state, then it turns out that because that vacuum state differs from the vacuum state that we would define in the room here, that a certain amount of those stable neutrinos are radiated to us from the early universe and just hang around until the present day. And so that very analogously to how a black hole is really in one state, Hawking pointed out black hole is really in one state, but an observer far from the black hole defines a different vacuum state, and that same mismatch is why the distant observer observes there to be a flux of particles emerging from a black hole. So it's exactly analogous effect here. So now it's that the state of the universe is really in one state, the CPT symmetric state, but the distant observer, us in the room today, long after the Big Bang, defined a different state. And so we observe a flux of particles radiated from the early universe. And anyway, either of these two approaches, there's a way to test if it's right, which is that the lightest neutrino should be exactly massless. So that'll be tested in the coming 3 to 5 years with cosmology, it turns out, by measuring the sum of the three neutrino masses, the light neutrino masses. There's another way, which is that you can predict the rate of neutrinoless double beta decay. That hasn't been detected yet, but it will ultimately be detectable, but not as soon as this first prediction. So anyway, those are the advantages of this neutrino standard model and anomalies. I'll have to wait until next time, and I apologize for running over. Anomalies and then other, next time will be anomalies and then a little bit about evidence for the standard model being exceptional. I'm running out of time. Okay. I know, it's becoming a blitz. Any questions?
Why does one of the Majorana neutrino not decay if it has a host decay?
They could all have in principle been unstable. There's nothing in principle that demands that it be stable. But in practice, you need it. It's the last remaining dark matter candidate in the standard models. If you want to say, is it possible to have the dark matter be in the standard model? Then the answer is yes. And it basically requires, in all of the different types of fermions, there are these Yukawa matrices, and the eigenvalues of the parameters in the three different generations are very different. In all those generations, between the up mass and the charm mass and the top mass, for example, the up mass is nearly zero. The up is until recently was thought to be possibly massless. And then the other guys can be much heavier. Why? Nobody really knows why. But so this would be an analogous statement in this neutrino sector. In this neutrino sector, that the three neutrinos would have to have three very different couplings. So it essentially is a saying that one of the couplings has to be exactly zero, which would be set by this Z2 symmetry, or at least very small, very approximately zero. We don't have a first principles explanation for why that is. Actually, at least we didn't. Interestingly, there has been a paper recently using asymptotic safety that claims to derive that at least one of the heavy neutrinos has to be at least one of the light neutrinos has to be exactly massless, I actually haven't checked that paper, but anyway, taking their word for it, that that almost corresponds to the statement that one of the other guys is. So it may be that there's some asymptotic safety argument that one of the neutrinos decouples in this, one of the neutrino families decouples in this way, where the lightest one is exactly massless and the heavy one is exactly stable. Those two phenomena are paired together, it turns out. But I don't really understand why that is. So I wouldn't say, it's more like we interpret this as a parameter, some parameters in the standard model that you then infer from experiment, namely from observations of dark matter, in the same way that you have to just infer the other parameters in the standard model from experiment. I wish we had a better explanation. My fantasy is that this asymptotic safety argument is a better explanation.